It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for June 26th, 2021. Today, the first stage of the Tour de France steps off and Olympic trials are still going on here in the U.S. July is going to be a great month for cycling. And this week's show is pretty dang interesting too, well, at least in my humble opinion. So do you want to hear the best bicycle pickup line ever? Harriet Fell chased down Sheldon Brown on a ride in 1979, and her first words to him were, "You're riding fixed gear, aren't you?" And the rest, as they say, is history. Sheldon and Harriet were married 8 months later. So let's fast forward to June 13th, 2021, when Harris Cyclery in Massachusetts, the home of SheldonBrown.com, announced its closing. The shockwaves could be felt throughout the cycling world about what was going to happen to Sheldon Brown's immense archives, a.k.a. SheldonBrown.com. Well, never fear, it's not going anywhere. In fact, since Sheldon passed away in 2008, the site, which belongs to his wife, Harriet Fell, has been lovingly and painstakingly managed by both Harriet and technical writer John Allen. In the second half of the show, we check in with The Outer Lines' Spencer Martin and Steve Maxwell for a preview of the Tour de France and some thoughts on the Olympics and how the U.S. is and has chosen our team. As Stage 1 gets going today in the Tour, Spencer is pretty certain that there are only a couple of riders strong enough to stand atop the podium in Paris in 3 weeks. And Steve and I once again discuss the absence of cycling on mainstream media and how our sport would so benefit from it. As I began to look into Harriet Fell, Dr. Harriet Fell, actually, I found someone much different from whom I expected. So much for expectations. Harriet has a PhD from MIT. She was a tenured professor in mathematics, but moved over to the College of Computer Science at Northeastern University as computers became much more mainstream. She retired after more than 50 years with an amazing array of accomplishments in her fields of study. But almost more interesting is her history with bikes, from building an aluminum fixie frame in 1971 that ended up in France for many, many years, and became an important piece of an industry lawsuit, to riding 8,000 miles in 2020. And she turned 77 this year. Joined in the second half of our conversation by technical writer John Allen, I think you will truly appreciate this amazing woman. Hello, Harriet. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, and thank you for joining me this week. We have a lot to talk about today. How are you?
I'm fine. Delighted to finally speak with you.
I would like to start with your background. I mean, it's very interesting. What you've done throughout your life, even though you're retired now, is very interesting. So tell us a little bit about where you grew up, how you chose your really interesting fields of study, and then we'll talk a little bit about your cycling and your current projects.
Okay, I was born and grew up in Brooklyn, New York, until I was 12, when my parents bought a house in Queens, and we moved to Queens. And I left New York to go to MIT the summer I turned 17. And so that sort of background. I got into math. I loved math and science. And honestly, I wasn't great at things like history and French, where you had to do lots of memorizing. I really just liked to work things out for myself. And so sort of unbalanced grades, but worked out okay for me. And I went to MIT and I got my doctorate there in pure math. And went from there, spent a year in France, we'll come back to that, and then got a job at Northeastern. And I was there for 44 years, actually, first in the math department, I was tenured in the math department, but left the math department in 1982 to help start the College of Computer Science, which is thriving. It's now Computer and Information Science, but a thriving college and very important these days. And I personally did that because I had to support the family. So that's another tale. but, you know, no, it just became clear to me that I was going to be the main support of the family, and I really had the potential to earn much more in computer science than in pure math. So it wasn't out of love. It was out of that kind of need. I had two kids, you know. Well, my second was on the way when I made the move.
Well, now that makes me want to know a little bit more about, I was going to put Sheldon toward the back end of this, but I think I'm going to bring Sheldon in right about now. So how did you and Sheldon meet?
We met on a Charles River Wheelman, now Wheelers, ride. We changed, the club finally changed their name to something not masculine.
That was nice.
So it was back, well, in 1979, and I went on this ride. We both went on this ride because Harold Lewis was leading it, and we both happened to know him and like him. And I can't say I was that happy with the club other than that, but I was sweeping with Harold on this ride, and we were going very slowly. Everybody was ahead of us. And then about an hour into it, someone went riding by really fast and yelled a hello to Harold. And I just said to him, "Harold, get on my wheel. I'm catching that one." And we were married later that year. I caught up to him, and my first words to him were, "You're riding fixed gear, aren't you?" No, it stuck.
And I guess the rest was history, huh?
That's right.
Wow. So you just like jumped on his wheel, you stopped, and you said, "You're riding fixed gear," and that was it? You fell in love with him?
Well, we got together. We actually met at a second ride, and on my first date with him, I built a fixed gear wheel for one of my bikes under his direction, and which I still use.
That is such a cool story. Let me take a moment to reintroduce you, although I can't imagine anybody who started listening to this wouldn't have gone right back to the beginning. We're speaking with Harriet Fell. She is actually the widow of Sheldon Brown, and if you don't know who Sheldon Brown is, you probably are new to this podcast and to bicycling. One of the most famous names in our world. And also, Harriet has some really interesting bicycle history, and that's where I'd like to go next, if that's okay with you. We'll get back to Sheldon in a minute. I want to go back to the project you did of building a bicycle frame, why and how it ended up in France. Hang on one second. I'm going to bring in John Allen. I'm going to tell him to be quiet, but I'm getting ready to add him to our call. Hold on. Are you there, John? Harriet, can you hear me?
There was a password.
Yes, I can hear both of you.
Okay. All right, John. So just stay with us. We're gonna start talking about Harriet's project in France. So are you okay with just kind of hanging out and listening?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, hang on. So I want to talk about this project in France. About the project of you building a bicycle frame and how it ended up in France. And then how it came back to the U.S. finally.
Okay, I'm going to fill in a little background. So I learned to ride a bike at 5. I got serious about it at 26 in France. I had a year's job in France. I went there during the summer to find an apartment. And I bought a bike and thought, oh, French people cycle. I'll cycle across the country. I'd never done anything like that before, and I was absolutely hooked within a week. So, that's how I got started with France. But back in the U.S., that was in 1970-71. In 1974, I was already on the faculty at Northeastern, but I heard about this project at MIT. It was an independent activities period. That is, the month of January, they run random other things than just real courses, and Sean Buckley, who is in mechanical engineering, was offering this class in building aluminum bicycle frames. And I just showed up and I bought a box of tubes and I started designing my frame and machine learning to use a lathe and milling machine and, designed and laid out this bike. And then it took forever, though. I mean, there was limited time on lathes and milling machines. And I ended up coming there every Tuesday for the whole spring semester to finish my frame. I constantly went around with a backpack with tubes in it. And then late in that semester, it was all done and Sean had a jig. I jigged the frame and it was sent off to a welder for aluminum welding, which is fairly technical. And he told me it was one of the strongest, lightest and strongest, both of which I'm sure because I'm small and I made it for me. So it was light and that also helps with the strength. But I was about to leave for France again. That was in the 1974, and I had arranged to take a year's leave of absence to work with some mathematicians in France. And so I had just finished the frame. I took it with me thinking, it'll be a project there to get it built up. When I got there, I got so far as putting on a headset and work. And then I was just busy with other things. So I ended up I stayed there 2 years, but I came back in 76 and left a whole bunch of things in a friend's cellar, hoping to come back within a year. I actually didn't get back for 12 years, but I left this frame hanging in his cellar. So that's how it ended up in France.
No wonder Sheldon fell in love with you. The kind of things you're doing, lathes and mills. I mean, that's what my husband does, but I don't, I just look at them.
Oh, they're big and powerful. It was really neat. I mean, I really think doing that project in part for me was, yes, I might have a bicycle frame at the end, but getting to use those machines was really something I wanted to do.
Oh, Brian would love for me to try to learn to use these machines, but I leave them to him. He builds bikes. That is what he does.
Right.
So I want to know about the controversy about this frame.
Well, the fact is, when I came back 12 years later, my other stuff was still there, but not the frame, because what happened with the frame was in 1985, Cannondale came out with their first aluminum bike frame. And Gary Klein, who had aluminum frames on the market, sued them. He said he had patents on all the technology and they had to pay royalties. And they said it was developed in public domain and he didn't have the right to those patents. So I got a call from Cannondale's lawyer asking if they could have my frame for this patent trial. And I said, sure, but it's in a French cellar in France. So the lawyer went to France. He picked up the frame and brought it home to Cannondale. And Gary lost all his patents in that trial. And my frame stayed with Cannondale for 10 years. I didn't even know who to contact to get it back, really. And in 1985, Sheldon mentioned he knew someone in Cannondale. So I said, can you call, see if they still have my frame? And 2 weeks later, it arrived at the house. And Sheldon opened it and hung it up as a decoration in the living room. And it stayed there. I really didn't have time to deal with it. It stayed there for 10 more years. So 2005, we're up to now. Sheldon asked me what I wanted for Mother's Day. And I said I wanted the bike to get on the road. That, you put 40 bikes on the road for yourself these past 25 years. How about getting that for me?
Right.
So that's how it finally got equipped and put on the road. And yes, I ride it still. I get high when I ride it. I mean, there's something, one, it's a fixie, and I like that. And two, I made it. There's something just special about that.
And, wow.
Just thoroughly enjoy getting out on it.
This is that shoemaker's daughter who doesn't get the shoes, right? That you didn't get
that's
the bike.
Right.
I know exactly what you mean. That is so interesting. So I want to go back just for a second to this controversy between Klein and Cannondale and how your frame actually influenced it. I remember
that
controversy.
Well, Klein developed his bike. He was in the same project. I mean, I knew him back then.
Who, Gary?
He built his frame at MIT.
Right.
But mine came before his. And
I see.
So did, I think there were four others there were five particularly strong ones that came out before Gary built his frame. And he used slightly different tubes. Well, Mark Rosenbaum also had picked different tubes. But, based much of it was in this public domain design. And I think also, I learned as I was trying to write up what happened at this trial only like a week and a half before I presented it at the Cycling History Conference, there's someone else who was not in our project had also built an aluminum frame. I don't remember his name. Sorry. Someone actually in the Midwest, that was already, before Gary. So Gary really wasn't entitled to all these patents. And I heard that he got one patent back 8 years later.
So I was both a Cannondale and a Klein dealer. And I remember at the same time, I think we had Cannondales and Kleins, and we looked at Kleins as a different sort of tier.
Well, he used really wide tubes, wider than other people, right.
And he had spectacular paint jobs, and that is, by the way, one of the things that really sold his frames. He also only had a couple of models. He had
powerful Seinfeld had one hanging at the back of his apartment, you know.
That's right. I do remember that. Let me take another moment to reintroduce you. In fact, let's take a real quick break. And when we come back, okay, we're going to talk with Harriet Fell some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I hope you're not just joining me, and if you are, please go back to the beginning of this podcast. We're speaking with Harriet Fell. She is a bike builder unto her own self, even though she isn't building bikes right now, but she predates an awful lot of frame builders today, and she's the widow of Sheldon Brown. We also have with us John Allen. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm just fine.
I haven't seen you since Philly a few years ago. I hope things are well for you.
I look forward to that again.
Yeah, me too. I don't know if we're going this year or not. But before we bring John in, he's going to tell us what's going on with the Sheldon Brown website, which, of course, Harris Cyclery closed recently, and that just sent up a bunch of shockwaves. And I want people to know that there is something good going on with Sheldon's site. So, Harriet, I want to go back to a couple of things. One is Perry Bress Perry in 1975. Obviously, you didn't ride that bike. What were you riding then, and how did you decide to do PBP?
I had a Holdsworth that I had made to measure in 1973, and that's the bike I had in France at the time, and I got hooked up with this club, and I didn't know what I was getting myself into, but I ended up riding Perry Bress Perry with them. It was a blast. And, I still have the Holdsworth. Right now it's set up on a trainer, but it's perfectly roadworthy. It's on its fourth paint job.
Have you done PBP since then?
No.
Just the one time?
I mean, that was 1975. It was the first year any Americans made it to the end. So although I was the fourth of four who made it, four others who started didn't make it. And it was the first year, like I said, any Americans got in. And I didn't do well in 1979. That's when I married Sheldon. It only runs every 4 years. So
right.
4 years later, I was married. Sheldon really wasn't into riding big distances. I mean, when I met him, he was faster than me for 50 miles. He refused to ever ride in relay, insisting I was too small to do him any good. But after the first 50 miles, he stayed on my wheel, because by then I was faster. And he really, you know, he did the occasional century, but that was really it. So I really stopped doing those kinds of distances. I had done two double centuries with the Narragansett Bay Wheelmen. I had dragged Sheldon on the second one, and he dropped out after 130 miles, and that was the longest ride he ever did.
What a whip.
I really,
just kidding,
you know,
of course.
He married me anyway after that. You know?
Yes, he did. Yes, and you guys have two kids.
We have two kids, and then neither of them cyclists. They're both dancers and mathematicians. They both have doctorates in mathematics, and my daughter is in California, in the Bay Area, and my grandson now is just turned a year old, and I finally met him a month ago. His name is Taylor, named after Sheldon, actually, who loved to sail and sing sea shanties.
That is awesome. And your son?
My son's in Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, nice town. Does he teach there?
What?
Does he teach there?
No, he's doing other work at the moment. He worked for Epic for a long time and, left that and is doing other work now.
So I have two more questions about Sheldon, and then we're going to talk about the website a little bit. And I know you are the owner of that website.
Right.
We think of Sheldon as being really, really complex and talented and such a prolific technical genius. What else do we not know about Sheldon Brown that would surprise us? I can't imagine.
Try to think about that. It's hard because Sheldon was so public about his life and his personal interests. You can read about absolutely everything. I mean, he didn't hide anything. He just put everything out on the web. And, so he was into singing and theater, and he loved to read history, alternate histories, and science fiction, and was extremely well-read and could talk. He could convince you he knew about anything, even if he didn't. One thing you may not know is he had a very hard time in school. I mean, they kept, as a kid, moving him from school to school. He just never wanted to do what other people wanted him to do. So, he went to many schools. The only college education he had was one semester at Berkshire Community College, and he dropped out after that. And I think he flunked physics because he had too many cuts. That was it. That was the end of his formal education. So, despite that, he just knew so much. He was really self-educated because he just read everything he could get his hands on.
Well, certainly, and if you have not, listeners, been to the Sheldon Brown website, it will literally blow your mind. You could just go take a cup of coffee or a pot of coffee and start reading it, and it will take you days, weeks, months to get through some of this amazing stuff on this website. And I am proud to say we actually have a product. It is not available right now, but it is on Sheldon's website. So it makes me very proud to say that. John, I want to ask you a couple of questions, and thank you for being so patient. So recently, Harris Cyclery did decide to close, and it was Sheldon's home base for so many years. What has been going on since Sheldon passed away in the last, I think it was 2008, and I think I actually met him at whatever the closest trade show to that was. He was in a wheelchair at the time. Harry, would that make sense to you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, John, tell us about what's been going on since then with Sheldon's website.
Okay. Well, it actually started with Harriet. She determined to keep the website going and to expand it, and set a deal with Harris Cyclery that the informational pages would become hers. She would own them, and she hired me in 2010 to, or was it 2009? I forget. Pardon?
It was 9 or 10. I don't know.
9. Doesn't matter anyway. But she hired me to take over the task of technical writing and editing for the site. I had been co-author of Sutherland's Handbook for Bicycle Mechanics and edited a book on bicycle repair and maintenance. So I was pretty well equipped to do that. Harriet also, and this is crucial to the preservation of the site's keeping going, Harriet put Google ads on the site. So that paid enough money to justify her and my continuing to work on it ever since. I'm sure Sheldon would have been just absolutely mortified to have ads on the site. He was such a populist, leftist, I could even say, but he had a shirt that he wore at my wedding in 1986, and across the front of it was emblazoned "Eat the Rich."
But it was under his tux shirt.
Yeah. Okay. But I have a photo of him wearing that shirt.
That's funny.
But anyway, so Harriet had ads put on the site, and that paid to keep it going. Just wonderfully, brilliantly, she is a computer scientist. And she was able to untangle the code that Sheldon had written and improve on every page so that they were easier to work on. Just as an example, now that we are disaffiliating from Harris Cyclery, the header of each of the pages is the same, and you have to change it in one place for almost all the pages, and boom, it's changed. So that kind of thing. And also just going through and improving the syntax, updating the HTML, while I continue to plug away at updating articles and writing new ones, and recruiting other people to do the same.
So that brings up a question for me about what kinds of things you're adding to the site. I imagine it has to do with things like STI, electronic shifting, hydraulic brakes, all of those things?
You know, actually, I have to admit, have not gotten to some of those things. We have covered the latest in internal gear Shimano hubs, including the electronic shifting, but we have not yet covered electronic shifting and 11, 12, 13, 14, God knows how many speed cassettes. I think we're up to 10 speed. There's it changes so fast now.
I know.
I really
right?
need to find someone who's an expert on those things, because the task is a bit overwhelming. But we do have very good coverage of internal geared hubs and many other topics, and a number of scientific and engineering articles as well.
So that brings up something else for me, Harriet, that I didn't think about, and that is, I know that Sheldon probably had a workshop that was just phenomenal in terms of pieces, parts, and knickknack and whatever. What is going on with all of his stuff?
Well, it's still filling most of my cellar, despite the fact that with John's help, I've given away or sold 40 bicycles, 11 large pairs of speakers, about 2,000 records. All the darkroom equipment is pretty much gone, and the cellar, which is a five-room cellar, is still full of Sheldon stuff. I also gave away 40 years of cycling magazines to the archive at UMass Boston, because they have an archive on cycling history, and threw out 40 years of photography magazines, but there's just endless stuff still down there. And the tools. I mean, right now, I think I have to make a major donation, now that we can do that again because things are opening up, of tools, because Sheldon had a habit, he put a tool down and couldn't find it, he just bought another one. And there are often 10 or more of each item piled up somewhere in the cellar, and I've been trying to sort those out and get them to people who really would like to use them. I don't really need to tell them I'm happy to give them away, but there's just lots of stuff. I mean, I still have three tandems down there, one of which I can pilot. The other two were for Sheldon to pilot. And there's a KidKid tandem. And just with Harris closing, I got two Moultons and a Peugeot that were Sheldon's, added to those things hanging in my cellar. So, it just somehow keeps accumulating instead of diminishing.
Wow. Who knew? Who knew? So are people approaching you I know, John, you said you were looking for somebody perhaps who could bring in some of the more up-to-date stuff. Are you being approached about the site in any way? So are people coming along and saying, I want to add to this? Or I know that Sheldon was always interested, if somebody found something that would be incorrect, he would correct it, although that would be rare for him to have something incorrect.
Oh, unless it was his HTML code, and Harriet could tell you about that.
Right.
But anyway, what was the question? I just
about people approaching you to either work with you on the site or add stuff to the site.
People have been approaching me with tales of woe. Rumors are circulating.
Right.
Oh no, Harris Cyclery is gone. SheldonBrown.com is going to go too. but it isn't.
Right.
And I keep telling them that. And everyone who writes in and says, oh, well, what can I do? I say, well, maybe you could write a page for the site. We really don't need anything else at this point other than the ability to cover more things.
Okay.
Right. And there are other people whose articles we've posted and find if more come in and we think they make sense.
Of course.
I get a fair amount of mail from people who just offer tiny typo corrections, even, you know, little additions or corrections, things that are technical. I forward to John. There's some mail that just comes in as thank you messages. I usually write back to those. And, I want my site on your link page. I said, oh, Sheldon set up that page over 13 years ago. It hasn't been updated since. And it's there for historical reasons. So I don't add those. But, you know, we're trying. It could use some updating, especially on the electronic equipment that's out there now.
Hmm. Okay. Well, for those who are listening, if you are aware of this and can do something about it, you can contact them. We'll give them that information about how to contact you or John, whichever, and to help out with that. The last thing I want to know, Harriet, is besides riding, and I know you're still riding because we changed the date, or we made the date for our conversation today because you were going on a 2-day bike ride. What are you doing? What else are you doing?
Well, I am retired, and I was doing a little math with colleagues before COVID set in. I'm doing a lot of drawing. I was doing an online abstract drawing class. I may pick that up again. I sort of usually don't in the summer because I'm doing more riding. I did ride over 8,000 miles in 2020. And I also play classical guitar trios every Friday morning, and I work on the site, and I'm lazy, you know, the rest of the time. With COVID, I spent far too much time watching TV and playing computer games, but, you know, things go up.
You know, I would not consider you lazy, and are you willing to tell people how old you are?
Well, I'll be 77 next month.
And there you have it. So if you want to call that lazy, I don't think so. I'm in my 70s, and I know people say, oh, you do all this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, because what are you going to do? Just sit there? No, I don't think so. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation.
I should say I'm the one who's lazy. I only rode 2,600 miles last year.
You are a slouch, John. Come on. You need to start keeping up with Harry. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation, and I really appreciate both of you taking time to talk with me. John, how can people contact you about the site?
There's a feedback link at the bottom of every page.
Oh, okay. That's perfect.
Well, those to me, and I forward things to John if they look like they need his opinion.
Okay. Well, Harriet, I hope you have a wonderful summer. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me and dispelling the myth that the SheldonBrown.com site is gone. It is alive and well, and we all miss Sheldon, and I know you do too, but I am glad that his memory is still so alive and so vibrant.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A great day and have a great summer.
Harriet
Phil and John Allen joined me from their respective abodes. She is definitely on my hero list, and I was thrilled to be able to chat with her. John and I have known each other for quite some time, and you can always count on him for his attention to detail and his precision in explaining things. If you want to get a sense of who Sheldon Brown was, log on to SheldonBrown.com. And remember to be prepared to take a trip down a deep rabbit hole. So let's take a break, and when we return, we'll catch up with The Outer Line's Spencer Martin and Steve Maxwell. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Well, it's Tour de France time, and for many, it's the pinnacle of the cycling calendar's grand tours each year. It will be interesting to see how it all shakes out at the end. And right on the heels of the tour is the reimagined Olympic Games. With COVID still not buttoned down everywhere, it remains to be seen how these events will be handled in Japan. Of course, we know that postponing them again would be an incredible financial hardship on the country. So let's get some perspective from Spencer Martin and Steve Maxwell from The Outer Line. Hello, Steve and Spencer. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's good to catch up with you two again. We are going to start with Spencer. He's got a hard stop that I want to get all of what we were going to talk about with him first. And the most important thing, I guess, is going to be the Tour de France. And it actually begins today. That's June 26th when this show launches up onto the up in the cloud or wherever in the heck it goes. So, Spencer, talk to me about the tour, and I'd like to start maybe with the La Course, the women's race.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, I'd love to talk about La Course. I was actually just talking to Steve where I they might not be promoting well enough, but it is tomorrow, Saturday. I don't know when people will be listening to this. It's pretty interesting route. Women cycling kind of struggles with, I'd say, route variety. A lot of the races tend to be kind of the same type of terrain, but this is actually a pretty difficult race with it's fairly long. I think it's like a 3-kilometer uphill finish. And I'd say any race that Mariana Voss is in, she's probably the favorite for, even though she's probably a bit of a, not quite at the same level she was at, you know, in her prime, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. But I have a hard time seeing anyone but Mariana Voss winning this. But there is Lizzie Deignan from Great Britain and Ruth Winder from the U.S. who didn't have a great U.S. National Championships last week, but is a very strong climber and could do well in a race in a course like this.
I think this is going to be the 8th running of the Women's Tour de France. And I'm glad to see it back. I think it's a really important race alongside of the men's tour.
So unfortunately, it's just a single stage. The longest it's ever been, I could be wrong on this, is 3 stages. And then I think that was the inaugural edition, and then they've been shortening it ever since. And now it's just down to 1 stage. And they used to do the final day of the tour, they would race it on the Champs-Élysées, the women, just earlier in the day. And then this year they've changed it to the first day of the tour, which is tomorrow. And it's just a single 108-kilometer race. But there is supposedly an 8-stage women's Tour de France coming next year in 2022.
Well, I have to admit, 2021 has been one of those years that's sort of trying to be a catch-up year anyway. You know, we had virtually nothing that went right last year. So I can understand that. Well, we'll have to wait and see who actually crosses the line first and stands at the top of the podium for the women. Let's move on to the men's Tour de France. I mean, it also is beginning the 26th, which is going to be actually the day this show starts this conversation. So I'd like to talk about a whole bunch of stuff with that, because one of the things I'd like to know is, do you see any surprises? And there were a few surprises this week coming out, like Chris Froome and Mark Cavendish. What other kinds of crazy stuff do you think is going to happen?
So, two-part answer to there. The first is, the tour does not usually have that many surprises. Usually the strongest rider wins, which is either Tadej Pogacar or Primoz Roglic. I believe in its grand tour that they've been racing, no rider other than them has won since 2019. So, these guys are head and shoulders above everyone else in the field. So I'd have a hard time believing anyone but Tadej Pogacar or Primoz Roglic wins the race. Having said that, though, this opening weekend is incredibly difficult. It's in Brittany, which is kind of a cold, rainy part of France, and they're going to get a lot of rainy weather, also a lot of wind. And the stages are really tough. This isn't your usual first week where they're just kind of rolling around doing some sprint stages, Mark Cavendish wins. These are really serious stages, and the time gaps are live. There's no 3-kilometer rule for the first 2 stages. So I think you could see a favorite or two either crash out or be caught out by crosswind this first weekend.
Hmm. I thought it was interesting that Chris Froome said, well, he'd be carrying bottles for other people, and that Mark Cavendish is back sprinting. So it's just going to be a different race from what I think we thought. The other thing that I wanted to bring up is Team Quebeca announcing their first South African rider, Nicholas, I think it's Dlamini. And what do we know about him other than the fact that he's very handsome?
I think he's their first. I think he's the first Black South African.
You're right. Okay.
Actually, I don't know that much about him. Yeah, other than that he's very handsome. I do know there was this kind of unfortunate incident in 2019 where he was assaulted by park rangers at Table Mountain National Park in Cape Town. And his arm got broken. It was kind of an unfortunate, like, police brutality incident. And that's the first time I'd ever heard of him. And then now, you know, 2 years, just I guess less than 2 years after that, he's making a start at the Tour de France, which is pretty impressive. I wouldn't say he's been like a prodigy. I think he's a very talented, you know, aerobic athlete, but he's kind of worked his way up. You know, he's definitely paid his dues in the South African racing scene and like worked his way up to a tour start, which is super impressive. And Steve knows the manager of that team, Doug Ryder, pretty well. And I think this is like a big initiative of his, is trying to get local South African riders to the tour. So I'm sure the team is very excited about this.
I guess. Let me take a moment to reintroduce you both. And I know that you're going to have to split here really quick. We're speaking with Spencer Martin and Steve Maxwell from The Outer Line. And if you do not know about their column in Velo News, and I get the airmail emails each week, and you can subscribe also at Outer Line, theouterline.com. Don't forget the. I want to ask you just a couple more things about the tour, and that is, do you see any stage in particular that might just separate, you know, some of the men from the boys, so to speak? What are the stages looking like this year?
So the funny thing about the tour is, I wrote about this last year. I have like a daily newsletter I send out that we're seeing this weird trend of the tour where these big set piece mountain stages actually kind of tend to be draws. And then you'll get a lot of big differences on flatter stages where riders are maybe more relaxed. They take their eye off the ball a bit, but crosswinds are kind of, it's crosswinds and time trials is where the big differences have been made in recent years. So I think these first two stages, they're both pretty pretty treacherous terrain, a lot of up and down. It's going to be a lot of wind, rain, and uphill finishes. You could see some gaps there. But as far as old school mountain stages, I think stage 8 is going to be tough. We do the Alps first this year, which is a little unorthodox. We do the Alps first and the Pyrenees second. And then stage 18, it's kind of a classic tour stage, but it's a little bit shorter. It's only 81 miles long. I think that's going to be a tough stage because when you get these shorter mountain stages, you know, it's kind of counterintuitive. You think it would be easier, but the pace is so much higher because the course is shorter that you can see some big differences there. And then also stage 5 and stage 20 are both time trials. And you'll just, that's where you'll see the most time difference. Not that I would totally recommend watching the time trials. They can be kind of boring, but as far as general classification, they're probably the most important ones. But no, I'd say that this opening week is going to be more interesting than people probably think. And then these mountain stages at the beginning of the second week, that stage 8 and stage 9, I think could be pretty interesting.
Okay. Very cool. Well, you mentioned something about watching, and I do want to talk about that. And I think Steve actually might be able to address that too. Is there anything else you want to say about the tour? I know you, as I said, I know you need to beg off here soon.
I'm just excited for it. I think that's the only thing. Big takeaway. You know, I think last year was a little, you know, I found it a little odd that it was in August and September, but I'm just excited for it to be back to its kind of midsummer time slot. And I think the GC could be a little bit of a wet blanket. It might not be as exciting as people think it's going to be, just because I think there are two riders better than the rest. But the daily fight for stages could be the best we've had, you know, really in modern history. We have a lot of really good stage hunters like Matthew Vanderpoel, who's making his tour debut. Wout Van Aert, Peter Sagan. I mean, these are historically great riders who can't race for the GC just because they're heavier, but are some of the best one-day racers the sport has ever seen. So I think the daily fight for stages is going to be, you know, at a level we haven't seen in many years.
Awesome. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Steve Maxwell about the upcoming Olympics. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to probably have to say goodbye to Spencer Martin from The Outer Line, and we're going to talk with Steve Maxwell here. Spencer, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today about the tour. We will all be watching, of course, and we will talk about some of the streaming applications that are available in our opening for the show. So thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having me. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, we'll talk again. And Steve, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Diane. Thanks. How are you? Good to talk with you again.
I'm really good. Thank you so much. And it's always great to talk with you, too. You're always so dialed in, and your columns are so good at Velo News. So I guess Japan is pretty bound and determined to get these 2020 Olympics, which are now 2021 Olympics, off the ground. Tell us, before we delve into the teams and some of the people who will be competing, what you think some of the issues might be. I know that they're now allowing 10,000 spectators. That's the last thing I heard. I don't know. Are there other issues that are coming up? What do you think about this whole Olympic Games?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, it's highly controversial, and it's been sort of an off and on thing, even since they were originally postponed last fall. You know, there's a large public sentiment within Japan against holding the Olympics. I think that the most recent kind of polls that I've seen suggested that some 80% of the Japanese population was actually against running ahead with the games. I saw just today that the emperor of Japan has taken the unusual step of coming out and kind of questioning the general intelligence of moving ahead with the games, and that's highly unusual in Japanese culture for him to say anything about political issues. The thing I would say, I think the way you posed the question, I would pose it a little bit differently. I think the argument now is that Japan doesn't really have the authority to cancel the Olympics, even though they're being held within the country, that authority or power somehow rests solely with the International Olympic Committee. And that there may be a good bit of sentiment within the population and in the Japanese government that these games should be canceled or postponed again, but that they're using the excuse that they don't really have the authority to do that. So it's a mess. You know, you're right. I think they have decided to limit the numbers of fans. I think they're going to basically not allow any foreign fans to come in to watch the games. There is already some kind of report that a couple of the teams apparently that are already in the country for the games have tested positive for COVID. And so I don't know. It seems like it's going to be a mess. You know, I think the challenge, or the, you know, if you took the IOC's perspective here, is that, you know, they've spent billions. I think the last estimate I saw was something like $15 to $20 billion of capital expenses preparing for these games. And if they don't use them and don't fill up the stadiums a little bit, there's going to be a huge financial impact. And so once again, we see, I think, sort of money driving the issue here. And it now looks like, you know, they are going to go ahead despite all of these doubts. So we'll see how it goes. I mean, what is that now? It's basically a month from now,
right,
when they're scheduled to get started. So I know that people are beginning to be issued press credentials and that sort of thing. So it looks like they're going to go ahead despite all of the controversy.
Well, I did sign up for the Japanese media, you know, the Tokyo media
I mean, I'm not going, obviously, but at least I can get the updates each day. So let's talk a little bit about the U.S. team. The choices have pretty much been made. I guess we just had our nationals in the last few days, week. So we have a new, I think, crit champion and road champion, and we've got our women's, you know, mountain bike champion and all of that. What about our Olympic team? Has it all been announced now?
Yes, it has all been announced. And you raise an interesting point there, because it was actually announced a week or two in advance of the national championships. And the national championships actually don't have anything to do at this point with selection of the team, which, you know, is a controversy. We did a thorough analysis and wrote a piece here a couple of weeks ago about the process of selecting the team. And it's, you know, it's a controversial process and system. I'll just try to explain it very briefly. The USA Cycling, the National Federation, has written a Olympic team selection document that they utilize in selecting the team. And it's a fairly straightforward and concise document for the most part. The criteria that the USAC does guarantee spots for certain selected pre-qualifying riders, but those are primarily winners of or high placers in world championship events. And unfortunately, we don't have too many riders that place highly in world rankings, particularly on the men's side. There are a couple of our women who consistently rate very highly in world competitions. But unfortunately, most of our men aren't at that level in the global competitions. And so what has ended up happening, Diane, is that there are very few automatic qualifiers under these criteria. And so then they have to jump to a sort of a more qualitative or subjective and discretionary process for selecting the rest of the riders. And this year, as we wrote in a piece here a few days ago, 6 out of the 7 road and time trial selections for the men and women's teams were actually discretionary. And so that involves a committee and some of the USA Cycling training and performance people making some, making some judgment calls. And obviously, when that happens, it starts to devolve into a more, controversial or questionable process. And so each year that happens, there are going to be, people who feel slighted and fans who feel that the wrong riders were chosen, et cetera, et cetera. This year, the two individuals that actually won the time trial events last week in Knoxville, Chloe Dygert on the women's side and Lawson Craddock on the men's side, actually were chosen for the Olympic squad. And so from the time trial perspective, it looks like folks who are among the strongest current riders were actually chosen to go to Tokyo. However, on the road side, and this is where the controversy is, most of the people who appear to be performing more highly at the moment were not chosen for the team. Neither of the men's or women's winners from last week are on the team. And so, it leads to a bunch of controversy and everybody's second guessing and Monday morning quarterbacking the choices. And there's at least one, and I believe maybe two riders who are going to a formal arbitration to challenge the selection. And of course that breeds ill will and uncertainty and so forth. And so the conclusion that we kind of came to is that this process needs to be more clear cut one way or the other. It either needs to be kind of automatic and returning to our kind of a trials type of format, like you suggested, just utilizing the national championships to determine who actually goes and that's final. The drawback to that, of course, is that occasionally, the top riders have a bad day or some unknown has a great day. And so we end up sending perhaps the wrong person, but at least it's clear cut. Or on the other end of the spectrum, just saying, hey, this is a discretionary process. The guys who are the coaches at USA Cycling are probably the most knowledgeable of anybody on this matter, and they're just going to make some choices, and that's just final. And that's what happens in quite a few other countries. Here we have this sort of uncomfortable mix between the two, and it allows this arbitration to go on. And so you can end up, you know, at the last minute with a lot of controversy and sending a team over there who may have been fighting amongst themselves for the spots, and some riders who maybe feel slighted and that they should have been there, and so forth and so on. So it doesn't seem like the optimal process. And so we've suggested once again that maybe after this year, that USA Cycling should take a harder look at this and figure out if there's a, you know, maybe a better way to do this so that we avoid this sort of last minute controversy and contentiousness.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you, and then we'll talk a little bit more. We're speaking with Steve Maxwell. He is one of the contributors to The Outer Line. If you read their columns in Velo News, they're always interesting and really well documented. They do a lot of research. They do a lot of really hard thinking about this, and I appreciate that, because that's why I come to you, because I get real answers. And Spencer Martin was with us. He had to leave, and he sort of, at the beginning of this conversation, gave us a rundown on the Tour de France. I mean, you know, we're talking about two things that are backing up right on top of one another.
You know, it looks like this year we're going to have a calendar that's going to be more or less, traditional in its nature. We, of course, lost the Paris-Roubaix again this year for the second year in April because of the sort of local pandemic situation on the ground there. But other than that, in terms of the major races, it seems like things are going to go off, you know, sort of on schedule, or, you know, at least at the moment. I guess we don't really, you never know where this whole thing is going longer term. But at least at the moment, it looks like the major races will go ahead. And as you said, the Olympics will start, you know, about a week after the tour is gone. That's another factor which we didn't mention earlier, but a number of riders have decided to focus on the Olympics rather than their commercial teams and the tour and so forth. And so that's also, you know, changed up the situation in the commercial races a little bit. And it's also, I think, led to a lot of uncertainty for those guys who have decided to focus on the Olympics, and, you know, this whole back and forth on and off again concern about whether or not they're going to actually happen. So it's, you know, we haven't emerged from this thing yet. It's still affecting a lot of choices and a lot of people's lives in terms of, you know, where they put their focus.
So the last thing I want to talk about has to do with actually spectators, and not necessarily in the venue or at the venue, but the spectators who are going to be, as we always are, watching Olympics, but also watching the tour. It looks like NBC's new Peacock TV is going to be streaming pretty much every stage of the tour. I mean, that was sort of what I saw, I think, in Velo News. And I know the Olympics, that's an NBC Sports, you know, popular. But do you have any idea of whether cycling will come into that sort of regular channel, or is it just going to be streaming on Peacock, which, of course, is a subscription?
Yeah, my understanding is that the full... the full stage, each stage will be fully broadcast and streamed on this Peacock, this new NBC Peacock streaming service. And my understanding is that it will be free to people who are Comcast subscribers, and that people who get their cable TV service from other providers will have to pay some sort of fee for the Peacock service. I think there is some option for a 3 month or a 1 month subscription, trial subscription at a discounted rate. So I imagine a lot of people will be using that for the month of July, or this period of June and July, to try to watch the tour. There will be, you know, it will be covered on other, you know, on other carriers in Europe. And there are, of course, ways to finagle access to that within the U.S., but I think you have to be a little bit, you have to be a little bit more creative on how you do that. So it looks like it will be fairly accessible this year, but, you know, that points out the perennial problem that we're always talking about, is the lack of coordinated TV coverage in the sport. And sort of like shooting ourselves in the foot. You know, we have a sport here which is pretty interesting and pretty exciting, and a lot of people would probably watch it if they knew how to or if they could easily do it, but they can't. And so we always come back to that same situation where we have this kind of, you know, mishmash of coverage and accessibility and people having in this country having to, you know, subscribe to three or four different services that at $100 or $200 a year in order to see all the races. And it always comes back down to that kind of frustrating problem. But yeah, I think we're going to have ability to watch the whole race. I'm not quite sure if we'll have two versions of the race as we did last year with sort of NBC Sports Gold and NBC Sports, where there's one kind of more, ad-free and continuous coverage for people that are paying and one for sort of, you know, free coverage on NBC.
Yeah, so you and I do talk about this a lot, that cycling is not the mainstream sport that we'd like to see, even though you and I know a lot of people who want to see cycling the same as other people want to see basketball and baseball and football. So right. I'm not sure what it's going to take to make those changes. I would think that perhaps medals will help, or another Greg LeMond would help. That would be something that would change people's minds, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, we certainly don't have the kind of dominant, you know, widely popular U.S. riders at this point in time that we, you know, that we did during Greg's era or during the Lance Armstrong era, which brought a lot of people into the sport just because right. We had a sort of a bigger than life, you know, guy and a absolutely top level performer in the sport. And while we have some, you know, good young riders and some promising talent, you know, American talent, and, you know, I think four guys in the tour this year that are American, I believe, you know, we don't seem to have anybody on the horizon. There's always young kids that are kind of projected as the hope of the future. And a lot of them are good racers, but there's none that seem to be emerging as sort of, you know, coming out at the very top level or sort of dominating the sport as we've had a couple times in the past. And you're right, until we have that, it won't be quite as popular in this country. But if it was easier to watch, it would certainly be popular, even though there aren't American, you know, dominant Americans.
Well, I know when I speak with Rob DeMartini from USA Cycling, he is focusing on the 2024 Olympics, which I guess are going to be in L.A. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
And he's hoping that our team will shine then, and that's what they are grooming our team for. But as far as the tour goes, it would be wonderful to see a USA rider come across that line and stand on the top of that podium.
Yeah, no, it would, and it would certainly build a huge amount of interest again in this country. But I hope Rob's right. I hope we can do that. I know they're working hard on it, but that hope is sort of a perennial hope that's out there that hasn't really been achieved for the last couple of decades.
That's true. Well, once again, we've been speaking with Steve Maxwell. He is with The Outer Line. You can go to theouterline.com. You can subscribe to their airmail newsletter, which I get, and always interesting to read his columns in Velo News. Spencer Martin and Steve Maxwell, The Outer Lines, thank you so much. We will catch up after all this chaos at the end of July. How's that?
That's great, Diane. Thanks for having us again.
And thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. My thanks to Spencer and Steve for once again joining me with their analysis of the racing scene. We will all be watching the Tour de France and the Olympics to see how our favorites fare. I highly recommend that you add The Outer Line to your must-read list, whether it's through their Velo News columns, their airmail newsletter, or on their site, theouterline.com. My thanks also to Harriet Fell and John Allen for a delightful conversation, and of course my thanks to you for listening. I have no big plans for the show next week as it's the 4th of July here in the States, but I'll come up with something for you. If you don't already, please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite app and take a moment to rate the show. Join the conversation on our Facebook page and follow us on Instagram. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance,
go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.